Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. So there are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. The first person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Martin, I thank you for your disclaimer today that you provided. It's appreciated. Joining us this evening, ladies and gentlemen, will be John. John is the point of the team, team leader, if you would. And tonight we're going to have a very interesting call on the subject of jurisdiction specifically, as it all pertains to that. And uniquely, we're going to be talking about something in the United States Code, 26 U.S.C., Section 7203, the willful failure to file, return, supply information, or pay tax. And you're going to hear something very interesting from John this evening on that. And perhaps if time allows, we're also going to discuss possibly a 1969 court case, Cesarini versus United States, which talks about valuables having been found in the United States, are taxable. So without further ado, it's my sincere pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John.
An honor and privilege, Michael. Thank you for that very gracious introduction. Jurisdiction is comprised of multiple facets. And to successfully have jurisdiction, you cannot be lacking one of those facets. Something that's very important is that if you live in a little town, say in the middle of Nebraska somewhere that has decided to implement a tax on pools, and that they also have special covenants and how you handle the pool and how it has to be cleaned and maintained and the requirements for, because maybe at some time a pool went derelict and many years earlier it became a festering bed for mosquito larvae, and amidst all of that a malaria outbreak happened, and that pool that was not properly maintained, they pointed to it to that cost a lot of people their lives and a lot of people some lingering difficulties. So they had a concern, a noble and considerate cause, and they passed laws and passed taxes to support the maintenance of those laws, and all on the pool. Now, that pool, first of all, if somebody's going to prosecute you for a statute, they can't just willy-nilly go off and prosecute you for one of the related statutes for owning that pool. First of all, without having what is called justiciable standing, meaning that the fact that you live less than a block outside of the city limits, to many inspectors, doesn't mean much. They'll try to enforce it because they say it's for the community's benefit, and that, and they'll even go plead before a judge that, look, he lives too close to the community. It granted, it's only a matter of double-digit feet from the city line. But if he lets his pool go, we could still have this mosquito hazard that plagued us before and caused us a lot of loss of life and caused some others some long-term health problems. And they will try and they will try and they will try to establish jurisdictional sovereignty over you. And what happens is that they literally they will push the issue to the point where they will fabricate justiciable standing to be able to prosecute you. However noble the cause, it's still technically, because you're maybe 82 feet outside the city limits, they do not have jurisdictional standing. Now, the next thing is that even though they try to prosecute you and they've invited you to a discussion before a constabulary about the fact that there are nowhere on their records is it pointed out that you have ever paid for the services of the city inspector to come out and look at your pool. And furthermore, they're going to complain. They're complaining that they have checked all of the contractors in the city, and you do not pay any of those contractors for their services. You have not engaged any of them to do the maintenance on your pool. And even furthermore, they've kind of they even went and got a court order, and they've looked at your spending records, and your little sleepy town is more than 300 miles from the next nearest large town. And the only three pool supplies within 300 miles are within 2 miles of your house. And they've got these records that show that you've never purchased pool supplies. And so you absolutely must be derelict. So one day when you're driving into town, they arrest you because there's a statute that says that you have to have your pool maintained weekly, and you've never engaged a single pool contractor to maintain it. You've never engaged anyone to purchase materials, and the local UPS and FedEx drivers, they've even got sworn depositions and testimonies from them that they have never delivered to you any pool supplies. And so now you're in their jail being charged with multiple misdemeanors and even a felony because they're calling the fact that, you know, you're not being considered for the potential mosquito risk, a felony reckless endangerment of your fellow person. And so these charges are very, very serious, and they're mounting, and they get into court, and you're winding up and you're getting ready to go for your criminal trial, and you're doing your pretrial motions, they're doing their pretrial motions, you're doing your jury questions, and they're doing their jury questions, and they make a motion in limine that breaks it down to the they say you can't challenge jurisdiction, you can't challenge their right to enforce these laws. You say that you're a sovereign citizen. They in the motion in limine, and what a motion in limine is that it's a motion to exclude matters from the jury's ears. And what happens is that in a jury trial, there's no longer a single judge making jurisdiction and decision and making authority in a specific case. Now there are 12 of them plus two alternates. Now the judge is technically a referee, and he's technically now there to just support, supplant the 12 judges plus two alternates that are out there. Most of these judges, for whatever reason, some of them are just tired of seeing bad guys go free. They let the prosecutors file these motions in limine, which means that they prevent you from bringing up a topic about whether the statute is lawful or etc. The trial commences, and they bring up all these witnesses that testify that they've never seen a pool guy at your house. They have somebody from the previous pandemic when malaria just plagued the town, and over half the town was overwhelmed with it, and many of them died. And they play the heartstrings of the jurors, and then they bring up the fact that somebody testifies from each one of the pool supply places that they've never sold you a single pool supply, chlorine, muriatic acid, pH balancers, anything. They, not a hose, not a vacuum, not a nothing. They bring in the FedEx guy, question him. Have you ever delivered? No, he swears on a stack of Bibles. The UPS guy, he swears. And you don't, you know, see, you know, you object to your irrelevance, and the judge says, I'm sorry, this is very relevant, overruled. And, they give you a chance to, cross-examine, the witnesses, but there's, you know, not much you can say to a FedEx guy that says he's never bought your pool supplies. You can say, you know, what do you say to that? So you let most of these witnesses go by the jury without seeing any retort from you, begins to believe you're guilty. As it begins to go, the trial, now going for two or three days, is about to end, and the prosecutor goes to before the jury and gives her closing statements, closing remarks, and look, this guy has never even attempted to try to be considered for his fellow person, and in the interest of the public health and public safety, has never spent one dime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he even claims he's outside the city, but he's so close to the city, he's within 100 feet of the city limit. Why shouldn't he be held to the same standards that those the lives of those that we're trying to protect? He says, in this, you can only find this man guilty. And you go up there, and you're looking at the jury, and you're doing your closing remarks, and you finally find out everything that the prosecution's been going after, and what you haven't been allowed to testify. And all you say is, I don't have a pool. I don't know where they got the idea that I did, but I don't have a pool. Never had one. I don't even have a hole in the ground to collect water. Is it within your latitude to find me innocent? There's a case where individuals are being prosecuted for like failure to pay income tax, and the code that Michael referenced is 26 U.S.C. 7203, and the title is Willful Failure to File Returns, Supply Information, or Pay Income Tax. And the first three words of that statute is any person required And what happens is that on this particular statute, when it says any person required, it's that clearly indicates that that there are individuals that are not required to file a return. And if you log on to Cornell Law, they that's usually the, you know, if you do a search on 26 U.S.C. 7203 and log on to Cornell Law, there's there'll be a highlight that'll lead you to 26 U.S.C. 7343. Now, 26 U.S.C. 7343 has more to share, and it's the definition of the term person as used in 7203. And it says the term for the use for this chapter is an officer, employee of a corporation, any member or employee of a partnership whose such officer, employee, or member under the duty to perform an act with respect the violation occurs. 12 weeks ago on the call, we talked about the Declaration of Independence and those inalienable rights that it talks about in the Declaration of Independence there, and in the paragraph 2, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, identifying that our founding forefathers had penned and formed this nation, believed and respected completely a intelligent designer or creator. But they endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among these are life, among these, indicating it's a much larger, that it's a larger pool of, or list of rights that these three are taken from. Among these are the rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And that to secure these rights, comma, governments are instituted among men, comma, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. It's very important that, you know, that November 19th, 1863, speech by Abraham Lincoln, that when he says that this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, this is what he was quoting. And the thing is that when we come to the Constitution, the thing that's very, very important that you realize is that the Ninth Amendment is one of the shortest amendments in the Constitution. It says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And what it's indicating is that there are powers and rights that supersede and are preeminent over the Constitution. When we come to the 16th Amendment, it says, well, we got a right to tax from whatever source that may be made there. But the thing that's very, very critical is that it says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without the apportionment among the several states and without regard to the census or enumeration. Now, if they can tax a right to the point that if you don't pay that tax, they take away the right, is that still a right, or is the law, the application being applied inappropriately? In the Declaration of Independence, it states, among these are the rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. To facilitate all of those, you have to be able to earn an income. And that means that if you take their right to earn an income away, none of those can be had. You know, you have to be able to buy bread for your children to eat, shoes for their feet, be able to buy property. And by the way, regardless of the fact that it's not specifically iterated, Property ownership is a right. It's not a privilege. The government cannot own and is not allowed to own anything more than the 10 square miles, District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., and whatever's necessary for forts, magazines, arsenals, paraphrased, military bases to supplant the common defense. Okay? Now, what happens is that these inalienable rights, if we can go to them and take them away by a tax, then they weren't really a right, were they? Or the tax was inappropriately applied. The oh, wait a minute. Declaration of Independence. That talks about their creator. That's interesting. They're endowed by their creator. And so what happens is that, holy shaving cream, Batman. The creator is what defines those rights and what can and cannot be done. The entities created by this creator, flesh and blood, organic, living, walking, breathing computers that can love and hate and understand and not understand and feel joy and pain and misery, those are the ones by the creator, aggregate human beings, aggregate individuals that are born with the breath of life given by their creator, by that intelligent designer. Oh, wait a minute. The U.S. government and the Constitution just created this, the 16th Amendment, and says the Congress shall have power to lay taxes. What entities are created by the government? And I don't mean just the U.S. government. I mean state governments as well. Corporations, limited liability partnerships, trust entities, those are all created by the government. So when it comes to when we sit down and in 7203 it says any person required, and then we look up 26 U.S.C. 7343 and we look at the definition of the term person. The term person is used in this chapter to include an officer or employee of a corporation or a member or employee of a partnership who, as such officer, employee, or member, is under duty to perform the act in respect to which the violation occurs. Wow. This is talking about only about entities created by government, not the creator. There is no place in the United States Code that makes definition to the that you or I specifically are required to file a 1040 or pay income tax. There are quite a few individuals that we're currently working with that there's a handful that I managed to or we managed to get involved with before they actually ended up in front of a bench. The thing is very, very important that that is extremely critical is that if we can get the individual agents to realize the failure before they push it up to somebody who's is almost keeping track of score as if the their daily job was a contest, and this is points toward getting to the end zone, and their eagles are involved, meaning prosecutors. I find that these have a tendency to wash away before we get to the point where it's referred to a prosecutor and it becomes an issue that an individual has been detained, arrested, however you want to call it, and has been invited to some discussing or cussing before a bench. And the issue is of critically prime importance that that there is an old saying, when you have aught, settle with your complainer on the way to court, lest you be handed over and given to the court, and the court gives you the bailiff, and the bailiff hands you the jailer, and you not be released until you have paid every penny. Once it gets to court, there's a lot of these folks, once it's on the docket, they quote unquote spent a lot of money and their egos are writing checks their butt can't cash, and they're not going to give up like a dog that's got a bone that's only got gristle on it or just a dry bone. They don't let go. And yesterday and today I had the honor and privilege of speaking with the gentleman who just got out, particularly on the this IRS thing, where somebody tried to fudge issues in the defense case try to make a whole defense on making a false representation that quote unquote the individual was allegedly had under 26 U.S.C. 6203, not 7203, which is what we're talking about, 6203, the tax assessment shall be made by recording the liability of the taxpayer in the office of the secretary in accordance with the rules and regulations prescribed by the secretary. Upon request of the taxpayer, the secretary shall furnish the taxpayer a copy of the record of the assessment. Well, this individual stated that when helping this this individual, it stated that tell him you filed 6203s and you know and the IRS never responded. Well, I didn't know about that when I came on to help this individual when it got to the point where they were halfway through the case when I was advised of what was happening, and I stood on the ground even at the appellate level. That of the statement that the 6203s, the government never responded, and so they the government had no standing to prosecute this individual. I come to find out after this gentleman's already been in prison, Sandstone prison up in Minnesota, for 3.5, almost 4 months, the clerk or a clerk. Now, if what I'm about to share really happened, I probably couldn't share it with you because it would be confidential. And if it didn't happen, I couldn't share it because it didn't happen. So for the next few minutes, I'm not me. I'm some other guy. I'm from the Bronx. If I happen to overhear a clerk share something that was present within the panel discussion that was reviewing the appeal on this particular case, she commented that, look, in the appeal, this, bargaining ice hole is explicative deleted. We'll use that term. The explicative deleted is lying again. And she stated emphatically that, after he stated that, after the justice said he's lying again about the 6203s, that the others on the panel agreed that they were going to slam dunk him and he was never going to see daylight again and that he would die in prison. Thankfully, we got a situation where I was able to get him released with less than 2 years of detention. But he was just released only a couple of days ago, actually the 22nd, just right before Christmas. And what happened was that I found out the clerk called another clerk at the trial court and says, oh, yes, they all were upset and they laughed and they argued about the fact that this guy said that he had made 6203 requests. And the thing is that in the past 90 days, I have had three people make very clear to me in no uncertain terms that neither the Treasury Department or the State Department gets a single shred of mail, and this includes snail mail and email, that they don't verify the etymology of it, and that it's not just it's scanned, imaged, recorded, databased, and then stored. And so that if this person mentioned two statutes here and three persons there, those are all like a nice Microsoft Access database. They're all searchable now. They have special scanners. She explained to me, now, if I had actually seen this, I was probably in a confidential area and I shouldn't share what I was, so I didn't see this. What I'm telling you now is a fairy tale, and is a supposition. But she showed, she might have showed me in my dream a scanner that did multi-levels of different bandwidths of light and picked up every fingerprint, identified the fingerprints that were on the document, scanned the envelope before it was opened, scanned the document, OCR'd the document, saved the images, the pictures, did a full fact rec, facial recognition identification on all the photos and everything that were in the picture, and it was all uploaded, and this 2.5-page document now had over 70 pages of information recorded in the computer within minutes. It's been identified to me that neither the Treasury or the State Department gets a single document, anything in the mail that they don't first record, image, catalog, network into inferential database, and before it's filed and or submitted to an analyst for review. And they showed me, and I was joking with the with somebody that I says, well, yeah, you can't see who I've claimed on my income tax before. And she says, let me see. It looks like you ran a halfway house in the 70s and early 80s, mid-80s, and you at one point were claiming six exemptions, not married, but you were claiming six exemptions, three on court order from this judge, two on a court order from this judge, and one on a court order from that judge, that you were taking early releases from a men's institution in Southern California. And he says, here's their names. He says, let me see, you... looks like you were personally funding them through college. Somebody did, and I says, how do you know that? He says, well, the IRS was concerned about you at one point, and they did a full fiscal analysis on whether you demonstrated income that did not match, and that your spending did or did not match your lifestyle and your income. And it turns out you were spending it all. It looks like were you a self-funded halfway house, I says. That's exactly what I was. And, I was working for the Defense Department going to law school. Yeah, that's right. And, she pulled up everything. And I says, how can we have this in electronic database right now? And that was long before computers. She says, all the hard copies, they've got over 21,000 people working for the Treasury Department that are imaging and scanning all the documents that have been in these files. So, and they are currently back to 1958. And they're going farther. And, at this juncture, and she says 12% of all the documents that come in right now go through these new scanners, and if there's fingerprints on them, they know who handled it. They have a special bandwidth imaging that shows up the fingerprints without having to dust them. And they also, and I says, now why would they do that? But she says, it's not what you think. After we received threatening letters from back after 9/11, the process was implemented because of phosphates, nitrates, and sulfates. They were trying to find letter bombs, and they were trying to see trace who was possibly generating these threats and verifying if they had been had access to or been exposed to or worked with any kind of potential accelerants, or is that something that could constitute a threat to them? And because you don't get something like that without an awful good reason. You don't get those kind of expensive toys to play with without an awful good reason and justifying it, not just to one parent, but to both parents, you know, and not just to their supervisors and their managers in that division, but also the Senate. So you have to, you know, the House and the Senate oversight committees, you know, for the funding. So you have to talk to both parents to get permission for those kind of toys. When it became clear that I realized that there had not been any 6203s filed in this particular case, my heart hit the dirt because I spent a shiny nickel on this gentleman's appeal. I spent a very shiny nickel on it. I had four of my paralegals working, one of them working weekends. She's very good, and I was having to pay her not just time and a half, but double time on this appellate brief that was based on these falsified documents that were created where this gentleman was assured by the individual that by the lawyer that was helping him that he paid him a very shiny nickel, and this lawyer lied to him and said, this is the only way you're going to get through this, but it's not true. No, trust me. He says, if you don't do, I don't care. They lie all the time, so that gives us justiciable standing to lie as well. Do it this way, otherwise you're going to jail. Little did they know that in the 8 times that he bought it up, the 3 times that I, you know, before he left the case, abandoned this gentleman, the 3 times that I bought it up in the case, that before he left the case, they were already knew that it was all falsified, and they were, magistrate justice, there were 2 magistrate justice and a senior justice involved in it. There were 4 prosecutors involved, and it was public knowledge. They knew, each other knew that they knew. They knew that the defendant knew. The defendant didn't know that they knew, but they knew the defendant didn't know that they knew. Everybody knew, and they just laughed. While the defense was completely corralled with a motion in limine, with multiple motions in limine, they couldn't bring up anything else except the fact that, in this case, oh, we've got bank deposit slips. Here's where they were swapping cash, small bills for large bills, or, you know, and doing it. And they, all those things that we talked about that happened with the pool company, they did with this gentleman. This gentleman was never, ever technically required to pay income tax. I've been working with multiple people. Some of them, one of them that was convicted a while back, he hasn't come to sentencing yet, but his status was corrected many, many years ago, but he didn't bring it up during his trial. He didn't even think to bring it up. And when I was brought in very, very late on the situation, it's we're right now I'm visiting the status to see the show in Abenicio that they never had original jurisdiction. While they had jurisdiction over income issues, the individual was never a United States citizen. So, at this juncture, what we're doing is filing a motion for rehearing, and also we're filing an attorney general question specifically on these cases. And what happens is that we're showing that one of the legs in these chairs, that you have to have in personam jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction, and you have to have subject matter jurisdiction. And if you take any one of the legs out of that little chair, the chair falls over. And this one, technically, they neither had territorial or in personam jurisdiction. They did have subject matter jurisdiction, but that's the only one that they had. And at this juncture, the one person we've got him out early, and we're working on his status right now, using that to get the subsequent penalties and fines that they've levied abated. We're trying to get the other another conviction overturned by getting the status corrected. I cannot emphasize enough that if you have or have not had the honor and the privilege of having some personal time with GW, that everyone needs to have, without question, their status corrected. Some people have asked me the question, John, you don't do anything with status. How can you say, et cetera, et cetera? That may or may not be true. I used to do status back in the 90s and the early 2000s. There were so many other things that I had to do that were so, so more important at the time that I quit doing that. GW is much better than I was back then. And if back then, if I had anybody that had a potential threat, we worked on getting their status corrected. And there's multiple ways that you can do that. I've seen people go through all kinds of fancy gymnastics, but I'm going to tell you something. GW, it has it simple, succinct, and concise. He's very straightforward. He and Michael do the job in such a way that it's almost handed to you on a silver platter. And to date, they have had zero rejections. Back when I was doing it back in the 90s, there were times when they rejected it and they didn't want to honor it, you know, and we had to come back and explain things and et cetera and go through unbelievable gymnastics sometimes. And I was I was constantly flying to Arizona. That was one of the worst places to do it at the time. But I was constantly having to go to Arizona and help these individuals. And we had to get many of them court orders to recognize their correction. GW's had to not do any of those gymnastics. I think it's of extremely critically prime importance that if they don't have jurisdiction, that we get that identified up front. And there's a person that in 1996, we did jurisdiction, status correction for. He's a Hebrew rabbi. He currently lives in Kansas, with his wife Carolyn. And we did their status many, many years ago. He was charged. I did not know what happened. He lost my number. Carolyn finally got through to me with some friends. we wrote a one-page letter asking questions. They dismissed the grand jury indictment against him. After we wrote a one-page letter, we included a copy of his apostilled affidavit, a photocopy of it, and I regret that back then we only got three copies made, but Stan and Carol still have two of the three copy originals, and so we make copies of it. But one single sheet, 14-point font, we ask questions. The prosecutor took the grand jury indictment, went back to the grand jury, showed them what was happening and why she was dismissing it. And the grand jury agreed with her. What happened there was that now there's a grand jury. There's one of them. One of 22 that are currently constituted in that state that knows and understands what an American national is and what the status is and the grand jury. None of those individuals, those 23 individuals on that grand jury, will probably ever hand down an indictment against someone like that ever again. The question is that are we willing to take the time to get educated on ourselves and be able to stand up against the question? And the question is that there's an old saying in a religious text that says, always be ready to give an account for the hope that you have. There's a couple that they had some challenges with they discovered some money in a piano. And this couple, they the Murrays, when they originally found it, they bought this piano back in 1957, and in 1964 they had the wildest discovery of, they found over almost $4,500 in old currency tucked away in the piano. Now, they unable to figure out who it really belongs to, they had it converted to new money so they could spend it. And on their 1964 joint income tax return, they filed it, you know, for, and on the 1964 joint tax return, they filed it as income. Later on, they realized that, wait a minute, this wasn't income. And so they filed an amended return requesting $836 back and 51 cents. They went through an ordeal that's nothing short of a French meat grinder and a French tenderizing meat grinder. They, under 26 U.S.C. 1201, they filed an amazing appeal to get $800 back. Now, back then, that's the equivalent of almost $6,000 now. So it was they were going after something that had high value back then. But it begs the question, and if any of you want a copy of the Cesar University of the United States, Michael can send that to you, or you can ask, and what I'll do is I'll send it to you. I can send it to you through Michael, but it's not a very long one, but if you're going to learn why there's an old joke about who has needless bruises, who has bloodshot eyes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a case of He who does not plan ahead and make himself as immune as possible to these kind of threats in advance, who waits till they are not just looking at fish in a barrel, but they're the fish in the barrel, that's somebody like the Murrays that went to defend the Cesarinis. They went through some unbelievable gymnastics to get this this judgment against the IRS. But that's only 6 pages long. It's worth reading. And if for nothing else, it's also to help you learn that correcting and establishing jurisdiction in advance is a vitally and critically important facet of everyone's life. The thing that we shared with you about 26 U.S.C. 7203, any person liable, that's the first three words, and if you need it, Michael will send you a copy of it that has those first three words highlighted, and you can just ask him, you know, send him an email to his email address. I just say 7203, and he'll send you the Cesarini versus U.S. And the 7203. But I guess to sum up tonight, and I've already run over, my apologies, making certain that you know what your jurisdiction isn't or isn't up front is vitally important before you get invited to a discussion before a bench. With that, I want to thank you all for your patience and your graciousness. I apologize for running a couple minutes over. The question and answer period is not limited to the topic of discussion that the subject matter that we covered this evening. You can actually engage in any subject matter, whether it's this call or previous call, or sometimes we'll even try to entertain questions regarding other information providers' calls. But if you can, if you're able to abstain and refrain to the subject matter for this evening, that's a blessing. With that, back to Michael. Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. It's a great, great call tonight. Great talk. How deep did you get into Cesarini at all?
I did.
Pardon me?
I did.
You did? Okay.
Park and Tilford Distillers versus United States, they had an excellent opinion on that, on taxation of found property and other windfalls, and that is an unbelievable case. It's almost as significant as Cesarini versus U.S., but
right.
The other one that was big was Needlin versus Weatherly. It was in Ohio. That once again it was assets discovered. Excellent case. Back to you.
Yeah, just to bring it home, my wife asked me, why have you corrected your status? Why? You're completely out of the system. You're completely off their radar. You hadn't filed since the last time you filed was 1993. They have no clue where you are, and you operate in total blindness to the world. They have no clue. Why are you doing this? And I said, well, there's a multitude of reasons. But the most important one for me is that tombstone over my grave. I want to say, here lies a free man, and then give the URL for people to look at to show what it is about to be an American by birth or to correct your status. I want to pass
you
a free man. Because what?
Born, you know, you don't want that born free and taxed to death on your tombstone.
No.
You know, for many years, I didn't have to correct my status. I helped a lot of people correct their status. And I was kind of in a gray area from the fact that I may have worked for the government at some point in previous life, and that they were kind of watching out for me, and they had kind of deactivated my SSN and a few other things, you know, done a few things to help keep me alive, and the rest of the other 1,273 of us that were working on that project. And but it wasn't until it got to the place where some very unkind people were preparing to mistreat my wife and son that I went ahead and got it corrected, because they've been kind of living under an umbrella. There's a lot of reasons why sometimes somebody doesn't get their status corrected. And I've realized that the whole way along, even though you have no idea how many people, and I don't either anymore. After the fire 8 years ago, I lost all, you know, most even the contact information, because back then it was in files and Rolodexes. A lot of the, through the 70s and 80s and 90s and up into the 2000s, and we were doing all that. So I don't have a clue pretty much anymore. I still remember the faces, but I don't remember any numbers. But from what I have seen happening today, having people making certain that their status is correct and that it's done now while the final phases of implementation of world computing is taking place, and that because after that takes place, all those records that are being established and built right now, and it's going to be hard to change that after that happens. But the sooner people get their status corrected, and some of the things that were brought to my attention that I was made aware of by a young lady, and I call her a young lady because she's almost 10 years younger than me, but I've known her since she was a supervisor at the State Department in Dallas, and I still call her a young lady, and I've known her for over 30 years, 32, and she helped me work with a lot of people. And helped me get passports for people that technically the State Department didn't recognize as acceptable candidates for a passport, a U.S. passport. But the things that she recently showed me just in the last 90 days, I'm a firm believer in that everyone should have their status corrected. And if their status was corrected, a lot of the challenges that we're currently dealing with the U.S. government and the Treasury Department would evaporate. Back to you.
All right. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 to raise your hand. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see that there's that rectangle silhouette laying on its side. Left-click into it and type away your comment or question. On the outside underneath, you'll see a place to put your name. Then hit submit, and I'll be glad to give voice to your comment or question. Press star 2, otherwise we're going to be an early call, and without questions, that doesn't make me happy. I did want to point out that we have two students now who have corrected their status and have had strong, positive results from their activity and interaction with the law. One you know is Jennifer Sue, which she got gutful and pressed the envelope before she was even in the proper seat to do it with. Anyways, the long and the short, from doing a 15 miles an hour over the speed limit or whatever it was on the interstate, she ended up having all the charges dropped against her for the sake of justice. And then there's another gentleman that, Nicholas, won't go into the details, but all the crimes were what are called malum prohibita. You've got malum prohibita and malum in se. Every law there is in existence divides between the two. It's one or the other. And as a malum prohibita, it's just basically, you can't do this because we said so. And it can be, well, Jennifer Sue's traffic was a malum prohibita. So you can't drive 85 because we said so. Anyways, point being is that with Nicholas's situation, he was in front of a judge for first appearance. How do you plead? Guilty, not guilty, nolle contendere. He made a special appearance, not general, challenged jurisdiction, evidenced his status, and the judge very wisely postponed everything for a couple of months. And at the same time, what she did was also, and when I say this, it's allegorical for those on the call that may be wanting to say something that was or have something said that wasn't said. She dodged the bullet, if you would, allegorically speaking, because on the map very soon will be civil lawsuits, deprivation of rights under color of law, Title 42, Section 1983, against both the law enforcement officer that pulled him over and then went carte blanche without a court order, warrant, or judgment under the guise of inventorying the contents of the car before it was taken away off the road, as well as the prosecutor. They will both be charged in this couple, 3 weeks. And this is all part of the strategy of dealing aggressively with bad-behaving people in politics, people in government.
Public servants. They're supposed to be public servants.
Right. Right. Again, press star 2, otherwise we're going to say goodnight, sweet dreams, and that's not going to be fun. Let me go check Freedom's Radio. All right, Brother Brian, you go ahead while I go check Freedom's Radio. You're open.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Hi, John.
Good evening, Brian. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, sir. Wanted to, my situation wasn't going as well as Jennifer's. I had another court date that got scheduled after we submitted the motion for reconsideration. And I called up there and talked to the clerk, and they said it was for me to go discuss my fine with the judge and how to pay it. It wasn't another hearing or anything. So I was able to get it pushed out to the 9th. I wasn't sure how we should approach this in particular.
Where are you in the path of your status?
That would be a good question for Michael. I'm at the status of part of needing to file my passport. I'm not sure.
I know what it was. John, Brian here cannot provide a social security number. There's issues involved.
Okay, that's a discussion.
Potentially, yes.
Okay, that's a matter for confidential discussion then.
Okay.
Brian? I tell you what, would you like to call back after the conference call is over, and we'll chat with Michael together?
Okay.
You up for that?
That sounds fine, yeah.
Okay. Then, let's table the rest of that for this evening after the call, okay? So,
which at this moment appears to only be a moment or two because nobody else has raised their hand. All right.
Okay.
Thank you all. I want to thank you all for joining us this evening. Remind you to return tomorrow night. Mr. Slevin will be sharing with you how to operate through an LLC with as much anonymity as anyone possibly could. And we'll talk about that tomorrow night. Same phone number, same pin, same time. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.